Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Good evening, everyone, and welcome back to our continuing class on the middle-length discourses. Now the winter is over. We can continue without interruption. Okay, and this time we will be taking in the middle-length discourses Sutta number 118. This is the Anapanasati Sutta, the discourse on mindfulness of breathing. This is page 941 in the book. Now, in the last series of talks that I gave before the winter recess, we studied the Satipatthana Sutta. And in the Satipatthana Sutta, one of the sections deals with mindfulness of breathing. But the treatment of mindfulness of breathing in the Satipatthana Sutta is confined to only four steps. But now, in this sutta, which is specifically devoted to mindfulness of breathing, we will see that this meditation subject becomes expanded, elaborated, unfolded into 16 steps or 16 aspects. Okay, but first we come to the introductory section. Okay, and the sutta begins when the Buddha was living in Savatthi in a place called the Eastern Park, also known as the palace of Migara's mother. In Savatthi, the Buddha had two monasteries. One was the famous Jetavana, also known as Anathapindika's monastery, which had been built for him by his devoted lay follower, Anathapindika. And I assume that was in the western part of the city. And then the Buddha had another very devoted follower in Savatthi, a woman whose name was Visakha. And Visakha was also known as Migara's mother, according to the commentarial explanation. Migara was actually her father-in-law. But when she got married, her father-in-law was a devotee of the naked ascetics, and he had a critical attitude towards the Buddha and towards the Buddhist monks. But Visakha very skillfully converted her father-in-law and the whole family to Buddhism, and through her guidance, her father-in-law became a Sotapanna, a stream enterer. And so even though Visakha was his daughter-in-law, he said that Visakha was his spiritual mother. And so that's why she became known as Migara's mother. And Visakha had built in the eastern part of the city, or probably to the east of the city of Savatthi, she had built this other monastery for the Buddha, which came to be called the Eastern Monastery, the Eastern Park, Pubbarama. And so when the sutta opens, the Buddha was living there, together with many very well-known elder disciples. These included the Venerable Sariputta, who was the disciple foremost in the faculty of wisdom, the Venerable Mahamoggallana, who was the disciple foremost in the development of the spiritual powers, the supernormal powers. The Venerable Mahakasapa, who was the disciple foremost in the ascetic practices, the Venerable Mahakachana, the disciple foremost in elaborating upon short sayings of the Buddha, explaining their meaning in detail and in depth. The Venerable, some other monks, Venerable Mahakotita, Mahakapina, Mahachunda Anuruddha, the Venerable Revata, the Venerable Ananda, who was his personal attendant, and other well-known monks. And it seems this was taking place during the rainy season when the sutta opens, or it's set against the background of the rainy season, for it says that elder monks had been teaching and instructing junior monks. Some were instructing 10 junior monks. Some had been teaching and instructing 20, 30, 40 junior monks. And then those new or junior monks who were being taught and instructed by these senior monks had achieved successive stages of high distinction. This means that by practicing according to the instructions that they were attaining the different levels of the jhanas, the formless meditations, different high stages of insight, and then reaching the stages of the paths and fruition stages, the stages of enlightenment and liberation. Okay, and so when the sutta opens, the occasion is called the Upasatha Day of the 15th. It's the full moon night of the Pavarana ceremony. The Pavarana ceremony is a ceremony that takes place on the last day of the rains retreat. The rains retreat is a 3-month period when all the monks have to stay in a fixed residence. They're not allowed to go traveling because this is the rainy season in India. And so when the monks used to go traveling during the rainy season, but people complained because when they would go walking over the fields and through the forest, they would be stepping on, many creatures would come out during the rainy season, and the monks would step on them, and it led to the accidental, unintentional death of many creatures. And so the Buddha made it obligatory. This was in ancient Indian practice, even going back before the time of the Buddha, that all of the ascetics would remain fixed, would observe fixed residency during the rainy season. And so during these 3 months of the rainy season, they don't go traveling about unless there's some urgent requirement, in which case they're supposed to return to their base monastery within 7 days. And then on the very last day of the rainy season, a special ceremony is held called the Pavarana. The word Pavarana means invitation. And the reason why it's called this is because on this day, all of the monks come together in the meeting hall, and going in order of seniority, each monk invites all of the other monks to criticize him for any faulty behavior on his fault, anything that the others have seen, heard, or suspected. And so they go from the senior monk down to the most junior monks. And so on this night, the Buddha is sitting out in the open. Apparently the rains have stopped now, surrounded by the order of monks, and they're all sitting silently, and then the Buddha addresses the monks and says, I am content with this progress. My mind is content with this progress. And so now he's urging them, those who have not yet completed their training, to arouse still more energy to attain the unattained, to achieve the unachieved, to realize the unrealized. That is, he's urging them all to make that full, wholehearted effort to attain Nibbana as soon as possible. And he says, I shall wait here at Savatthi for the Komudi full moon of the fourth month. That is, normally when the rains retreat is over, the Buddha would pack up his things and then set out wandering. But on this occasion, the Buddha realizes that there are these junior monks who are being trained by all of these senior monks, and that this is, to use a cliche, it's a golden opportunity for those junior monks to achieve final liberation within that time period. And so he's saying that he's not going to set out on traveling right away, but he'll wait until the fourth month. This is the fourth month of that particular season, until the month called Komudi, that's until the following full moon. So he'll wait in that place for another full month so that the monks who are still engaged in the training can complete their training. And so the monks who are living outside in the countryside heard that the Buddha is still continuing to stay on at Savatthi, and so they left their rains residence in order to come to Savatthi to see the Buddha. And so the elder monks continue to teach and instruct the junior monks, and the junior monks continue to train and to practice, and they reach these different stages of high distinction. And then in paragraph 7, the Komudi full moon arrives, the Uposatha day, that's the full moon day. And this month is called Komudi because on this full moon night, there's a kind of water lily called the Komudu water lily, which is supposed to blossom on that particular, the full moon night of that month. Okay, so now there's an even larger group of monks because it's been expanded by all the monks who have arrived from the countryside. And now again they're sitting out in the open, and the Buddha addresses the Sangha and he says, Bhikkhus, this assembly is free from prattle. This assembly is free from chatter. It consists purely of heartwood. He's praising the qualities of the Sangha. And he says, such is the Sangha of Bhikkhus, such is this assembly, such an assembly as is worthy of gifts, worthy of hospitality, worthy of offerings, worthy of salutation, an incomparable field of merit for the world. Such is the Sangha of Bhikkhus, such is this assembly, such an assembly that a small gift given to it becomes great, and a great gift becomes greater. Such is the Sangha of Bhikkhus, such is this assembly. What's meant by saying that a small gift becomes great and a great gift becomes greater is that when gifts are given to the Sangha, they generate merit. And so a small gift given to the members of the Sangha generates a great amount of merit, and a large gift generates still a greater amount of merit. And so he says, this assembly is rare for the world to see. This assembly is worth journeying many leagues with a travel bag to see. Then he goes, he's now in paragraph 9, he's going to start to enumerate or describe the qualities of the monks in the Sangha. in this Sangha of bhikkhus, there are bhikkhus who are arahants with taints destroyed, who have lived the holy life. This is the standard description. Done what had to be done, lay down the burden, reached their own goal, destroyed the fetters of being, the fetters of existence. That is, they've destroyed all of the 10 fetters. And they are completely liberated through final knowledge. So in this passage, the Buddha is describing those monks who have reached the fourth and highest of the four stages of enlightenment. But not all of the monks have reached that stage yet. So in the next paragraph, he describes those at a still lower stage. In the Sangha of bhikkhus, there are bhikkhus who are non-returners. These are monks at the third stage of enlightenment. And here we have the description of them. With the destruction of the five lower fetters, they are due to reappear or to be reborn spontaneously in the pure abodes and there attain final nibbana without ever returning from that world. Such monks are there in the Sangha of bhikkhus. Okay, what are these five lower fetters? I've gone through them earlier, but just to recapitulate. The five lower fetters are first the fetter of, call it the view of self or identity view, the view of a truly existing self that exists in some relation to the five aggregates, either is identical with the five aggregates, with one or another of the five aggregates, as possessing them, as located within the five aggregates, or as the container in which the five aggregates are located. So the unenlightened person, the so-called worldling, is always picking up and adhering to one or another of these different views of a self. But one who eradicates the fetter of identity view no longer can hold to any view of self. The second fetter is doubt. Doubt about the Buddha, doubt about his teaching, doubt that there are people who have followed the teaching and reached stages of enlightenment through his teaching. The third fetter is called silabhata paramasa, call it wrong grasp of rules and observances. That is, the belief that by observing certain rules, following certain observances, it is possible to reach liberation. The fourth fetter is the fetter of sensual desire. And the fifth is the fetter of ill will, hatred or anger. So the non-returners have eradicated all of these five fetters, and because by doing so, they are no longer subject to rebirth within the particular domain or realm of existence that we call the sense sphere realm. But they're not yet fully liberated. The word non-returner means that they don't return to the sense sphere realm. It doesn't mean that they're fully liberated. But they take rebirth in what is called the form realm. the realm in which matter still exists, but there's no longer the grosser forms of the grosser types of sense objects, and no longer the obsession with sensual enjoyment. And within the form realm, there is, we use the expression, special gated community, special set of realms, or we call them states of existence that are reserved for non-returners. These are called the pure abodes, and only non-returners can take rebirth in those realms, in those states of existence. And once they take rebirth there, they don't come back to this world, to the sensual world, but they reach final liberation within the pure abodes themselves. Okay, the arahant, the one who has completely destroyed the fetters of existence, he has destroyed also the five higher fetters. That's the fetter of craving for existence in the form realm, craving for existence in the formless realm. That is the realm in which there's no material form at all. He's also eliminated conceit, especially the root conceit, which is the conceit I am. They've eliminated doubt. They've eliminated restlessness. And then finally, they've eliminated avidya, ignorance. Okay, then working downwards now, in paragraph 11, the Buddha says, in the Sangha of bhikkhus, there are bhikkhus who, with the destruction of three fetters and the attenuation of lust, hate, and delusion, are once returners. They return once to this world to make an end of suffering. So these practitioners, they destroy the fetters of view of self, doubt, and the wrong grasp of rules and observances. And they weaken or they attenuate lust, hatred, and ignorance. And so they still have some sensual desire left, some tendency to anger and ill will, and of course they still have ignorance and delusion. And so they come back to this world, to the sensual world, but they only come back one more time. But actually, according to the Abhidhamma commentaries, they might come back two times. Because if they reach the attainment in the human world, they can be reborn in one of the heavenly worlds and then come back to the human world one more time and reach final liberation. If they reach attainment in the human world, they can be reborn in a heavenly world. Then they can reach final liberation there. They can't be devas, that is, celestial beings, can also reach the stage of once returner. They might come back to the human world and then reach final liberation here, or they can reach final liberation in this one more birth in the heavenly realms. So there are different permutations. But if they attain as human being, and they come back to the human realm, only one more time they come back. Okay, then in paragraph 12, we have the fourth and lowest grade of enlightened persons. These are described here as the bhikkhus who, with the destruction of the three fetters, are stream enterers, no longer subject to perdition, that is, to the lower realms, bound for liberation, headed for enlightenment. Okay, the stream enterers destroy the first three fetters, just like the once returner. But they don't really significantly reduce lust, hate, and delusion to the same degree as the once returner does. But by destroying the three fetters, they can no longer take rebirth in any of the lower realms. No longer rebirth in the hells, not in the sphere of the hungry ghosts, not in the realm of the animals. At most, they have seven more rebirths. Those seven rebirths take place either in the human realm or in the heavenly realms. And they are niyata, that means, here it's translated, bound, or definite or fixed in destiny. I think it's dui ding, perhaps, in Chinese. So it's their destiny is definite. And they're headed for sambodhi parayana. They're headed for final enlightenment. Okay, then in the next paragraph, the Buddha is describing not stages of attainment, but the types of practices that are undertaken by the monks and the Sangha. There are monks who abide devoted to the development of the four foundations of mindfulness, or the four establishments of mindfulness, those we have gone through in detail in discussing the Satipatthana Sutta. Then there are monks who abide devoted to the development of the four right kinds of striving, the four right efforts. This is the effort to abandon, to prevent the arising of unarisen, unwholesome states, to abandon arisen unwholesome states, to develop not yet arisen wholesome states, and to fulfill or perfect arisen wholesome states. Then the four bases for spiritual power, the five faculties, the five powers, the seven enlightenment factors, the Noble Eightfold Path. Such bhikkhus are there in the Sangha of bhikkhus. I go through these remaining classes rather quickly because within a few suttas we're going to come to sutta number 77, in which we have a detailed treatment of all of these 37 aids to enlightenment. And so when we come to that sutta, then we can examine them in more detail. Okay, then paragraph 14 takes up some of the meditation practices of the monks. There are in this Sangha of Bhikkhus monks who abide devoted to the development of loving kindness. This is metta, of compassion, karuna, of altruistic joy, mudita, and of equanimity, upekkha. These four belong together as a set known as the four immeasurables, also called the four divine abodes, sublime states, the four Brahma-viharas. Then comes the meditation on asubha, translated here as foulness. This is the unattractive nature of the body, the perception of the body in terms of its constituent parts. The body is made up of head hairs, body hairs, nails, teeth, skin, different tissues, organs, fluids, and so on. Then the perception of impermanence. This is actually insight into the impermanence of the five aggregates. Okay, so now the Buddha has gone through praising, we call this these introductory meditation subjects, and now he comes to the subject that's going to be the theme of this discourse. He says, in the Sangha of bhikkhus, there are bhikkhus who abide devoted to the development or to the meditation of mindfulness of breathing. This is what is called anapana sati. The word anapana means in and out breathing, and sati is mindfulness. And now the Buddha, before he elaborates on this meditation, he's going to praise the potency of this meditation. And then he's going to show briefly how this meditation, this one meditation subject, has such a great range of potentials, how it will actually bring to fulfillment the entire Buddhist path. He says, when mindfulness of breathing is developed and cultivated, it is of great fruit and great benefit. When mindfulness of breathing is developed and cultivated, it fulfills the four foundations of mindfulness. When the four foundations of mindfulness are developed and cultivated, they fulfill the seven factors of enlightenment. And when the seven factors of enlightenment are developed and cultivated, they fulfill true knowledge or final knowledge and deliverance, liberation. Okay, so this, we could say, in this paragraph sets out what will be the framework of the Buddha's treatment of mindfulness of breathing in this discourse. First, he's going to take mindfulness of breathing and then explain it in terms of these 16, what might be called 16 steps, or better, 16 aspects. Then he's going to collect the 16 aspects into four groups, which correspond to the four foundations of mindfulness. And by collecting them in this way, he shows how they bring to fulfillment the four foundations of mindfulness. Then the four foundations of mindfulness constitute, or they center around, the practice of mindfulness. And mindfulness is the first of the seven factors of enlightenment. And so when the mindfulness is fully developed through the practice of the four foundations of mindfulness, it actually unfolds or brings into being all the other factors of enlightenment. And then when all of these seven factors of enlightenment are developed and cultivated, when they are all activated and brought to maturity, then they culminate in that complete final knowledge, which itself brings liberation. And so we could say that the entire Buddhist path, in a sense, literally lies right beneath one's nose. Because it's at the nostrils, or the area just below the nostrils, that one experiences the breath coming in and out. Okay, so now the Buddha is going to explain systematically the practice of mindfulness of breathing, showing how it becomes of great fruit and great benefit. Okay, and he begins, the first part will be exactly the same as the opening of, as the section on mindfulness of breathing in the Satipatthana Sutta. Here, a bhikkhu gone to the forest or to the root of a tree or to an empty hut sits down. Here the Buddha specifies the ideal places for practicing this meditation subject. Because ideally, to do the mindfulness of breathing, especially for gaining deep samadhi, a quiet place is advisable. And so in the Buddha's day, there are many forests, and so one can go easily to a forest to practice there. And within the forest, one would find a tree, or sometimes an isolated, secluded grove, and sit down at the root of a tree, and one could practice there. But if one doesn't have the opportunity to find the forest or a secluded place at the root of a tree, any quiet place, what's called an empty hut, is a suitable place for developing this meditation. And it's said by some great meditation masters, even if you can't find a quiet place, even if there's noise and disturbances, but if you just continuously keep your attention on the in-breath, the out-breath, when the concentration becomes really good, then there can be a lot of noise going on around, but the mind won't be disturbed. But it's better if one finds a quiet place. Okay, now we come to the first, we call this the first tetrad, the first set of four items. Oh, but I still haven't finished with this, with the first paragraph. Okay, he goes to an empty hut and sits down, then folding the legs crosswise. This doesn't necessarily mean sitting in the lotus posture, but sitting in any kind of comfortable position with the legs crosswise. One sets the body erect, holding the body upright, not stiff, not rigid, but upright. And then one establishes mindfulness in front of one. In my understanding, this doesn't necessarily mean at this point that one puts the mindfulness in this area here, but I take this to be just an idiomatic phrase to mean that one sets up mindfulness. But in doing the mindfulness of breathing, the teachers in the Buddhist tradition, or at least the Theravada Buddhist tradition, advise always to keep the attention in the area of the nostrils or someplace around the nostrils, wherever one feels the breath coming in and going out most distinctly. I've heard some teachers give explanation that one should follow the breath from the nostrils in to the body, down to the belly, and follow the out-breath from the belly all the way through the lungs, out to the nostrils. But I don't think that could be correct, because if one is followed, at least for gaining, for the practice of samadhi meditation, because if one is following the breath from the nostrils down inside the body, then from inside the body up and then out to the nostrils, the mind is not remaining focused in a single point. And so one is not really able to settle the mind upon a single area and keep the mind in an unmoving area in the way that's necessary for gaining samadhi. There are types of meditation that seem like mindfulness of breathing, but are not actually mindfulness of breathing. For example, in the type of Vipassana meditation coming from Burma, established by Mahasi Soyador, one follows the rising and falling of the abdomen. That meditation subject seems like mindfulness of breathing, but it is not intended to be mindfulness of breathing. And Mahasi Soyador himself said that it is not mindfulness of breathing. That meditation subject, one is following the rising and falling of the abdomen, which is based upon the breath, because the abdomen rises and falls as one breathes in and out. But what one is actually following there is movement or motion, not the breath. And so by following the motion, rising, falling, rising, falling, it helps initially to develop some degree of samadhi. But the purpose of that approach to meditation is not to develop the very strong samadhi leading to jhana, into deep concentration, but to move directly into insight, to vipassana. And so by following the rising and falling, one has an object which is readily available. It's easier to follow than the subtle sensation of the breath. And it makes immediately clear the rising and falling movements. And from there one can observe the different changes in the rising and falling sensations. And from there one can move into, very directly into insight, into impermanence, the constant change in the rising and falling movements. But that is a different meditation from the mindfulness of breathing, which, according to the explanations of the commentators, should be developed in the area around the nostrils. Okay, so the initial stage is being simply mindful, ever mindful when breathing in, ever mindful when breathing out. That is establishing the initial mindfulness of breathing. Now, with paragraph 18, we move into the first tetrad. Okay, breathing in long, he understands, or we could say simply, he knows, I breathe in long. Or breathing out long, he understands, I breathe out long. Then this is followed, breathing in short, he understands, I breathe in short. Or breathing out short, he understands, I breathe out short. Okay, these two sentences or observations go together. And in these two sentences indicate, might call, observation of the particular length of the breath in terms of the two classes, two grades, long and short. Now, in the Buddha's practice of mindfulness of breathing, one isn't attempting to regulate the breath. It's not like a yoga pranayama exercise in which one will draw in, take an inhalation for a particular number of seconds and breathe out for a number of seconds. Then one will change the breath, sometimes quick, sometimes slow. But one just breathes naturally at one's normal rhythm. But here one is observing the length of the breath. And initially, when the breathing is coarse, the breath is long. As the breathing becomes slower, more subtle, then the breath becomes shorter. It actually takes a longer time to complete a breath as the breath becomes subtler. But the breath seems to go through a shorter part of the tract of the body. Whereas when one is still in a somewhat excited frame of mind, then the breathing is coarser, rougher, and so it's considered to be a long breath. Okay, so one breathes in long, breathes out long, breathes in short, breathes out short. Okay, then we come to the third sentence. He trains thus. And notice here that there's a difference in the wording. The first two sentences are simply understanding, pajanati, or knowing whether the breath is long or short. But here it's a deliberate process of training, sikkhiti. One has to train the mind in this way. He trains thus. I shall breathe in. In fact, those words of breath should have been taken out. They were from the first edition. I wanted them taken out, but by an oversight, I left them in this sutta. And I'll explain why. Okay, I shall breathe in, experiencing the whole body. He trains thus. I shall breathe out, experiencing the whole body. Let me just read the Pali. The Pali says, Sabakaya patisangvedi asasi samiti sikati Sabakaya patisangvedi pasasi samiti sikati. The Pali says simply Sabakaya. It uses the expression whole body. But now there's some uncertainty or ambiguity, what is meant here by experiencing the whole body? And now the commentaries say, in this phase, what one has to do is consider that the breath has three stages, three phases. There is the beginning, which is the initial moment of drawing the breath in. The middle, this is say in an in-breath, the initial moment of drawing the breath in. The middle, which is that whole process of drawing the breath in. And then the end, which is the stopping of the in-breath. And then the out-breath also has three phases. The phase of the initial moment of breathing out, the middle phase, that whole process of breathing out, then the end phase, that very moment when one reaches the end of the out-breath. And so the commentary says that whole process, beginning, middle, end, that is the whole body of the in-breath. The whole process of breathing out, beginning, middle, and end, that is the whole body of the out-breath. And so to be experiencing the whole body of breath means when one is breathing in, one is aware of the three phases in breathing in. Aware of beginning, aware of the in-breath through the beginning, middle, and end. When one is experiencing the whole body of breath while breathing out, one is aware of the entire out-breath from the very moment of beginning to breathe out through the whole exhalation till one reaches the very end of the out-breath. And so that means the whole body, experiencing the whole body, being aware of the entire in-breath and out-breath through beginning, middle, and end phases. Okay, I used to think the commentary was completely correct on this, but and so following the commentary and also the advice of some others, in the first edition of this book I added to Venerable Nyanamoli's translation, I put in brackets here of breath after whole body. But then it struck me that if one just stays with the word of the Pali, that one has the expression subakaya, which simply means whole body. And then also the word that comes after that is patisangvedi. Now, the word patisangvedi has a sense of experiencing rather than the sense of awareness or knowing. It's more akin to, you might call, the feeling aspect of experience than to the knowing aspect of experience. In fact, the root of that word, you have vedi, you see, vedi is related to the word vedana, which means feeling. And so it's what seems to me to be the case is that what is taking place here is that while breathing in and breathing out, one is now, the awareness is now expanding to the point that it can, while having the attention focused in this area, the awareness or the range of experience can now encompass the whole body and take in the whole body while the attention is still fixed at this particular point, at the nostrils, around the nostrils, where one feels the breath most distinctly coming in and going out. And I think this can be related to the experience in the jhanas. And it might be suggesting a stage in the development of mindfulness of breathing, either approaching close to the jhana or within the jhana itself. And I find some support for this if one takes a look at page 367, this is a standard way of explaining the four jhanas. And we take the first jhana. I'm in paragraph 15. The text is now describing a monk who has abandoned the five hindrances, and he enters and abides in the first jhana, accompanied by applied and sustained thought, with rapture and pleasure born of seclusion. Okay, he makes the rapture and pleasure born of seclusion drench, steep, fill, and pervade this body, so that there is no part of his whole body, it uses the expression there, subakaya, unpervaded by the rapture and pleasure born of seclusion. And then the text goes on to use the simile of the, call it the barber or barber's apprentice who's going to preparing a ball of bathing powder or shaving powder in a metal basin, sprinkles it with water, and then mixes it so that the water pervades that soap powder entirely inside and out. Then we get similar simile in paragraph 16. Paragraph 17 also. Paragraph 18 also. We always have the expression, the whole body there, being pervaded, completely pervaded by the qualities within that particular jhanic attainment. So I don't think that this sentence, coming back to the Anapanasati Sutta, that it necessarily indicates that the meditator has already reached the jhana, but it seems to indicate what I would call a widening or expanding of the range of experience, so that perhaps as the piti and sukha, the rapture and happiness, the joy and happiness, are building up along with the development of concentration, they're now experienced as pervading the whole body. And so he's now, with the attention still focused at the nostrils, around the nostrils, he's experiencing that joy and happiness extending through the whole body. Okay, and then the next pair, he trains thus, I shall breathe in, tranquilizing the bodily formation. He trains thus, I shall breathe out, tranquilizing the bodily formation. Here the text uses the word kaya sankara. And there are suttas which identify the bodily formation with in and out breathing. An example is sutta number 44 in the Majjhima Nikaya. This is the Chula Vedala Sutta. There is a passage on the formations on page 399. You don't have to turn to it, but you could just take the reference. It's paragraph 15 there. or actually it's paragraph 14. It says simply, in-breathing and out-breathing are the bodily formation. In-breathing and out-breathing are called the bodily formation because they are states bound up with the body. They are bodily states bound up with the body. And what is indicated here is that as the process of meditation on the breathing goes to deeper and deeper levels, by itself the breath naturally becomes more and more quiet, more and more calmer and calmer. When it's not actually, in my understanding, what is not actually deliberately training to make the breath become more and more calm, more and more tranquil. One is simply training to attend more and more closely, more and more consistently to the breath. But as one does so, naturally, automatically, as a result of that process of training on the breath, the breathing will become more and more tranquil, calmer and calmer. And as the meditation goes into each successive jhana, the in-breath and out-breath becomes calmer in each of the jhanas, until it's said in the fourth jhana, in-breathing and out-breathing stop completely. So the meditator in the fourth jhana is no longer breathing in and out. Somehow the body gets the oxygen that it needs. How that happens, I don't know. Perhaps can the skin take in enough oxygen to sustain the body? But it seems that this sentence is indicating that process of continual calming down, tranquilizing of the breath, which reaches its culmination in the fourth jhana, when the breath becomes completely tranquilized in the sense that it stops. But also, along with the breath, there are many other bodily processes that are sort of bound up with the breath that also become more and more quiet, more and more tranquil, as the mind becomes more deeply absorbed and focused upon the in-breath and out-breath. Maybe at this point I'll ask whether there are any questions.
Maybe you could just get a few
words on how the mind becomes more focused. You're saying you're not deliberately tranquilizing, not deliberately tranquilizing the mind, but as the mind becomes more focused, it becomes calm. So, how is the mind becoming more focused? Yeah, just simply by attending to the in-breathing and out-breathing. I mean, what has to be done to get the mind more and more focused on the in-breath and out-breath? Okay, this will go back to the stage of being ever mindful he breathes in, mindful he breathes out. Okay, in the initial stages, and it could be that many thoughts come up, many distracting thoughts, and what one does is, the initial stage is whenever the mind strays from the meditation subject, one just becomes aware that the mind has strayed, and one brings the mind back to the sensation of the breath coming in, going out, at this area around the nostrils, sometimes it could be slightly inside the nostrils, at the rims of the nostrils, wherever one feels it most distinctly. Any discomfort in the body, again, one tries to ignore it as much as possible. If necessary, one can make minor adjustments in the posture, because for the mindfulness of breathing to proceed successfully, the body has to be fairly comfortable. It will not really succeed if one is in a lot of pain.
About the Sapakaya Satisan Reading. First of all, I still think the original sense fits better with the practice, because for two reasons. Number one, Sapakaya, as you mentioned in Sutta 44, it could mean just body or also breath, in and out breath. So it doesn't really, only because it says Sapakaya, it means body. So it could be either way.
Yeah. In fact, there is a line in the Anapanasati Sutta itself. It will come a little bit later in the sutta, where the Buddha is correlating the different aspects of mindfulness of breathing with the four foundations of mindfulness. Actually, it's on page 945, about a quarter of the way down the page. He says, "I say that this is a certain body among the bodies, namely in-breathing and out-breathing." Kayesu kayan yattarahang bhikave etang badami yadidang asasa pasasam. Yeah, in fact, it's on this basis that the commentators identify the whole body in that previous paragraph with in-breathing and out-breathing. So there can be some basis for it. And also, I would have to say that, in a way, your comment ties back with Peter's question, how to get the mind more focused on the in-breath and out-breath. Okay, after the noting of whether the breath is long, whether the breath is short, in order to get the mind more consistently focused on the breath, one of the useful exercises or techniques or skillful methods that one could give oneself is to make the determination each time, before each in-breath, before each out-breath, to follow that in-breath and out-breath through that entire process from the very beginning right up to the very end of the in-breath, then to follow each out-breath through the entire process from the very beginning right to the end. So I would say that in developing this meditation subject, the method of resolving to follow the entire in-breath and out-breath through all beginning, middle, and end phases, out through beginning, middle, end phases, is useful and even valuable. But I still have some question whether that is the original intended meaning of this paragraph. I have to say that there's the weight of 2,000 or at least 1,500 years of Theravada commentarial tradition against one weak little voice of myself with my little heretical opinion. But I'm not alone in this. Even the great meditation master Goenka also, who's usually very orthodox in his opinions, and very Burmese in his opinions, but he rejected the commentarial explanation of experiencing the whole body of breath, the whole body to mean experiencing the entire in-breath, the entire out-breath.
But the second critical point is that this part comes before you feel body formation, before you feel experiencing rapture, which is connected to your reference to the jhana.
Yeah.
Actually, when you do the breathing in and breathing out,
yeah,
the initial stage will be growth.
Yeah. Yeah.
When, unless you reach, which is really stubborn,
yeah,
and actually really stubborn body, you cannot reach rapture, because rapture, you said rapture,
yeah,
born of seclusion, born of
seclusion. Yeah.
So here the rapture, jhana feeling, the jhana rapture,
yeah,
comes after.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, it's a very good point. Okay, her, this is just for the recorders. Suki's point is that she says that my explanation doesn't seem to be acceptable because in the explanation of mindfulness of breathing, the experiencing of rapture, the experiencing of pleasure or happiness comes in the next section on, and not in the section on that we, not in this particular tetrad. That gets your point across?
Yeah.
Yeah. Born of seclusion. Yeah. Yeah. What I would say is that that way of understanding it assumes that the six, what I call the 16 aspects of mindfulness of breathing are 16 steps, and that the observation of the body steps, this particular tetrad that we've just gone through, and then the next set of four, taking in rapture, pleasure, and so on, is something that necessarily comes later. But I would see it somewhat differently, that they're not to be understood, at least the first three tetrads, those dealt with in paragraphs 18, 19, and 20, are not necessarily to be seen as sequential. You know, one following the other. But to use an analogy, it's the way, this is an analogy from an area that I don't have much experience in. The way photographers produce a multicolored film by taking, they take, what do you call them? Sections with different color schemes, and then they blend them so that you get, they're called the color separations. Then you blend the color separations to get the picture with full color, the full-colored picture. But then when you take the separations apart, what you see is one picture which might have a scheme with, say, yellow and blue, another frame with maybe a green and violet, another section with what color scheme? Red, blue. I had red, blue, yellow, blue, green, purple. Okay, red and something else. Because brown is a mixture, I think, comes from mixing. Maybe white, or maybe it's black. Anyway, one has these different frames and with different pairs of colors. Then when you combine them, you get one master picture in full color. Okay, so what I would say is that the actual meditative experience is like the master picture in full color, but then you can look at that experience from different angles in terms of the different satipatthana, the different foundation of mindfulness that one is using as the basis of contemplation. So it becomes, you might call this, like a frame of reference for viewing that experience. And so within paragraph 18, one is viewing that experience. The first exercise is by way of observing the breath, understanding it as long, understanding it as short. That is preparatory. But taking the experience of the whole body and the experience, the training in tranquilizing the body, that one could take to be... And I said also, it's not necessarily jhana. It could be also the stages building up to the jhana, as just as the mind becomes concentrated and is moving into sort of hitting the runway leading into the jhana, and also the jhana itself. Just as one is experiencing the body, okay, so one is experiencing the body more widely, more panoramically, with a different slant on that experience, one will be highlighting the experience of rapture in the body. With a different slant, highlighting the experience of pleasure or bliss within the body. But one could backtrack from the rapture, from the pleasure, and just be observing it as an experience of the body itself. In that case, one would be within the contemplation of the body and of the breath within the body.
Is there a mindfulness of breathing meditation that is not also satipatthana? So I'm getting the sense from starts with the opening of this that saying you can do mindfulness of breathing so that it is satipatthana.
I think within the Buddha system of meditation, mindfulness of breathing just naturally becomes satipatthana because it's an observation of the body. But of course one can be doing a mindfulness of breathing meditation. Definitely one doesn't have to use it to go into jhana. In fact, there would be root in the sense of roadway, not root in the sense of the root of a tree, roots that one could take using the mindfulness of breathing meditation that don't go use it as a vehicle to get into jhana, but go directly into insight. It would be like a difference in emphasis. And when we'll still be experiencing rapture, pleasure, and still tranquilizing of the breathing will take place, but the mind is not going into the jhanic states, but going directly. One has to get a certain base of concentration, but then from that base of concentration, one will slant it towards insight. That is, instead of focusing continuously or exclusively upon the breathing, just as one is focusing upon this area in the mode of calming the mind, when the mind becomes very calm, a nimitta or sign arises. That's like the visualized object of meditation. And when one shifts the attention onto that and merges the mind into that, that is the way into the jhana. But if one doesn't focus on that nimitta, but instead attends to the changes that take place in the breath, the constant differentiation of in-breath and out-breath, and all of the changes taking place in each in-breath and out, each out-breath, then there's not enough, there's not the type of consistency in the object of awareness suitable to the, conducive to the arising of the nimitta. And so the mind won't go into that, that nimitta or visualized object won't arise, and the mind won't go into the absorption state. But by attending to these differences, these subtle differences, with very, very focused attention, one is starting to see changes taking place at subtler levels. And by observing these changes, then the mind is getting attuned to the observation, the observational awareness of impermanence. And in that way, one is going into the contemplations in paragraph 21. So there will still be the stages, one will still experience rapture, pleasure, and so on, but not in the jhanic, with jhanic intensity.
So just quickly, so did you just describe three different routes for breathing meditation?
No, I described
jhanic and insight, and is that insight satipatthana, or satipatthana have something in addition to those two?
Satipatthana embraces both of them, but I think it'll become clearer as we go along. I'll just take David for a quick question in the back, then we have to stop.
This is a one-pointed meditation, so it can be used with Vipassana, right?
Yeah.
Could it also be used with the divine abode?
The mindfulness of breathing is its. The question is, can the mindfulness of breathing be used together with the divine abode's meditation? At the time one is practicing the mindfulness of meditation, one is not practicing. One cannot simultaneously be practicing the divine abode meditation. But one can be practicing these two meditation subjects, say, within one's day-to-day life, in that one could be, say, practice mindfulness of breathing for a certain period, then one can stop that and then develop the loving kindness meditation for a certain period. But the mind can't be focused on two things simultaneously. Okay, then we have to stop now. It's getting late. And we end with the sharing of the merit. Share the merits with the devas, the buddhas, and other beings. Akasata cha bhumata devanaga mahidika punyantam anumoditva Chirang rakantu sasanam akasata cha bhumata devanaga mahidika punyantang anumoditva Chirang rakantu desanam akasata cha bhumata Devanaga mahidika punyantam anumoditva chirang rakantu mang parang etavata cha amhehi sampadang punya sampadang sabbe deva anumodantu Sabba sampati siddhya etavata cham hehi sampadang punya sampadang sabbe bhutanumodantu Sabba sampati siddhya etavata cham hehi Sampadang punya sampadang sabbe satanumodantu sabba sampatti siddhya.